Let's come before the Lord and turn our time over to Him, shall we? Father, again, we do say thank You for Your amazing grace and Your abundance to us, that You have allowed us to live in a place and in a time when most of us have never known need. We've only known the absence of things that we like. But Father, in Your grace, You have entrusted so much to us. May we be good stewards with our time, with the things that You've given to us, with your Word. May our fellowship tonight be blessed, and would You strengthen our understanding of Your Word, that Your Spirit might use us all the more for Your glory. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, thanks to Mike Riddle, who this is how Mike's life is. He was here last week, but he's probably out of town today. Can't be here tonight, but I appreciate him filling in for me last week, and I listened to his presentation. I knew it would be good. It always is. So he's another one of our church family that you can pray for. He has multitudinous opportunities locally and around the country for doing creation apologetics, and I know he blew my cover, if he didn't already know it, that I'm going to go teach with him for a week next August for the Creation Apologetics Training College. So I'm looking forward to that, and we'll appreciate your prayers for that as well. Now, put you in context where we are in the book of Revelation. We have looked at that scroll, that book, that Jesus took from the hand of the Father. It's sealed up in seven segments, and He's been opening that scroll. The analogy, the word picture that is based upon is the idea that a piece of property that had been under bankruptcy or something like that could be recovered if the person that could open that scroll could fulfill all of the terms of it. So that's why it's been called the title deed to the earth. Now, He's opened the scrolls to progressively reveal the unfolding of end times events that are going to happen in the 70th week of Daniel. He's opened up six of those. The first four were all similar. What was similar about the breaking of the first four seals? They all had horses involved, a rider on the horse symbolizing events of the early seven-year tribulation. Then He opened up, or He broke seals 5 and 6, and you get to the end of the sixth seal, and people are crying out and for the mountains to fall upon them and hide them because the great day of the wrath of the Lamb has come. Hide us from Him who sits on the throne, they say, which is God the Father, and from the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come. So that tells you that the wrath of God has begun to be poured out with the opening of those seals. Then, can you picture in your mind, I lined up seven people here holding S1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And when we got to number 7, that person was facing this direction and holding up hands. Because what do you get when you open up the seventh seal? It unfolds to reveal seven angels with seven trumpets. And we're going to start, we've actually started blowing trumpets. We've gone through the first four trumpets. There are similarities to among the first four trumpets. And when you get to the end of the fourth trumpet, you have this. This is where we left off last time I was here. The time before that, because last time we spent time talking about textual criticism, which was, I had a blast. I hope you did too. Revelation 8:13. Then I looked and I heard an eagle flying in mid heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." So as terrible as all the judgments to this time have been, all of the outpouring of God's wrath, everything as bad as it is, now they're saying, "Woe." And I don't mean "woe." Woe is like cursing, damnation. woe. It's going to get worse in the next three that are about to sound. So that's where we left off. And with the fifth trumpet comes a whole new dimension to these trumpet judgments. There's now going to be demonic powers unleashed against mankind. And I forgot to ask, does anybody need the notes that we're still working on? Pages 84 through 91. David, would you be paper monitor? And we're on page something or other. We're on page 88 right now. Now, the side trip that we took was based upon what I read to you from the New American Standard Translation, and you'll find that in most of the more current translations. It says, I heard an eagle flying in mid-heaven. But if you look at the King James or New King James or some others that don't have as much manuscript background to them, it says, I looked and I saw an angel flying in mid-heaven. So we had a good discussion about that. Why? What's the difference? And I gave you a first guess. It's probably a manuscript different reading, and I kind of vaguely remembered that. Well, you have the word eagle, which in Greek is aetu, and you have the word angel, which in the form that it would be in that sentence would be angelou. They both start with an A. They both end with an U. They're both three syllables. They're very similar. So you can see how they could possibly be confused based upon hearing. And you might, you know, if somebody was reading this, they might have heard something. But it actually is probably more significant than that. The vast majority of manuscripts say angel. Only a very few manuscripts, I'm sorry, the vast majority of manuscripts say eagle. Only a few manuscripts say angel, including the single manuscript that the translators of the King James used. Hence, they didn't do any manuscript comparison. They used one fairly late manuscript, and it had angel there. So the question then is, well, if we have a bunch of manuscripts that say one thing and a bunch that say another thing, how do you decide? Well, one way is, what's the majority? How, you know, number of manuscripts? If we have 9,000 that, well, we don't have 9,000. If we have 5,000 that say one thing and 50 that say the other, it's, you know, that's kind of predominantly in favor of the more common one. But that isn't the only thing. Suppose those 50 that we have are way older than the 500 or the 3,000 that we have. Well, choose the older rather than the younger, right? So, or rather than the later, because the closer they are to the original, the less, the fewer opportunities there have been for a copying mistake or something to be changed. But there's also another one that you, another principle that you use. Which one of them is harder to understand? Because no scribe would take something straightforward and change it to something more difficult. But if he's reading something that isn't immediately straightforward and it sounds a lot like another word, he gets, oh, well, you know, that was, I know it says eagle there in this one that I'm copying, but I've read all the way through the book of Revelation. There's another place where an angel flies around and makes an announcement. And all through the book of Revelation, angels do all the announcing. So it's very easy to explain how eagle would get changed to angel. And there's virtually no explanation for angel having a logical reason to be changed to eagle. And in this case, we have more manuscripts, older manuscripts that favor eagle. And then there's another one I didn't give you too much to do with, but it was if we're comparing manuscripts of a verse and or a paragraph or something, and one of them has 100 words in it, and the other one has 106 words in it, Everything else being equal, which one would you think would be more authentic? The shorter one. Not the longer one, the shorter one. Because it's easy to understand how things could get added in, but for a scribe to remove something was absolutely unthinkable. And we can even see situations where we have a manuscript that's very old and it has this reading. And then we see one that's a little bit newer and it has that same reading and it has a marginal note. And then you find one that's later that no longer has a marginal note. But what was in the margin is now in the text. So that's how things get what we call conflated. Okay? And this really, 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 really irritates King James only people. Because the manuscript that the King James translators used, which was a very good manuscript, but it has many conflations in it. There's your word for the day. Where there are more words there than others. So I told you, one of the things to look out for when you hear somebody discussing translations and manuscripts is somebody says, well, your translation leaves out such and such, or omits such and such, or removes such and such. That's starting with the presupposition that the longest is the best. The most words is the best. And that's not a valid assumption. Okay, we have beaten that horse completely, beaten that eagle completely to death. And the fact that it is eagle is a good testament that that was probably what was there, because you can see eagle being changed to angel, but not angel being changed to eagle. All right, now, with this fifth trumpet, that was the end of the description of the fourth trumpet. With the fifth trumpet comes this whole new wave of something in these judgments. As I said, this is demonic powers that are now going to be openly unleashed against mankind. This really will be a kind of hell on earth. And you're going to see it in these next three judgments very specifically. And I decided this was a good place to take one of our side trips. The only difference is this one is scheduled and you have notes for it, as opposed to the one on manuscripts. The bonus is on the subject of demonology. What are demons? And it's a very legitimate question to ask. Why would Satan or demons want to harm men and women who are already on their side? In other words, why would Satan use his forces to attack people that have already bought his party line? And I think that's a very fair question. The answer is that you have to get past your logical thinking and realize that Satan has no regard whatsoever for the well-being of humans. Not anywhere, not anytime, not any of them. His whole reason for existence is to battle against God. And part of his battle is doing anything he can to keep from having his way with men. So Satan doesn't mind killing people if they aren't believers. Oh, and he doesn't mind killing believers either, if God permits it. So even though you can't usually see it, there is this great spiritual battle going on. God, who loves men and who sent his Son to redeem them, is battled by Satan, who doesn't love anyone, except perhaps himself. But he hates God so much that if God wants man's fellowship, Satan's going to do everything he can to prevent it. And if God is not willing for any to perish, Satan is going to gladly snuff out people when given the opportunity. So I think it's good for you to know a little bit of background about angels and demons. Angels are mentioned a lot in the book of Revelation. And as you're about to see, demons are mentioned very prominently in the book of Revelation. So let me give you a little background in angelology and demonology. So this is a theological sidebar to put alongside the book of Revelation. Let's start with Satan. He was apparently created as the highest of the angels. And in the Old Testament, we have two passages. They are disputed by some people as to whether they apply to Satan or not. I've actually investigated that pretty thoroughly and kind of gone from definitely talking about Satan to, oh, those are pretty good arguments, maybe not, back to, I really think they do speak of Satan. There are two passages in the prophets that are addressed, one against the king of Tyre, T-Y-R-E, the other a king of Babylon, and they're pronouncing curses, pronouncing judgments, if you will, woes, to use the Revelation word, against those two kings. And the words of these two texts seem to go far beyond just the earthly wickedness of these very wicked kings, and they seem to describe what motivates them or who motivates them. And it has been believed for centuries that this goes back to describing the fall of Satan, because he is the one ultimately whose bidding these evil kings are doing. I'll show you these two passages. The first is Ezekiel chapter 28, verses 12 through 15. Son of man, take up a lamentation, or a mourning, if you will, over the king of Tyre, and say to him, thus says the Lord God, you had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Would God say that about a man? There's got to be something beyond that, right? You were in Eden, the garden of God. Well, I don't think the king of Tyre was in Eden, but I know who was, who is still around. That would be Satan. Every precious stone was your covering. And now it's going to get kind of into describing something that we don't know exactly how to take all of this, except it's describing brilliance and beauty. The ruby, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the lapis lazuli, the turquoise, and the emerald. And the gold, the workmanship of your settings and sockets was in you. On the day that you were created, they were prepared. Well, Satan is a create. Angels are created. And this one is the one created on that day with these special accoutrements. You were the anointed cherub who covers. What's a cherub? That's a word for an angel, okay? And an anointed cherub, a special one, it seems. And I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. And again, that can't apply to only an earthly king, because no one who was born since Adam and Eve has been born without blame. In different words, we have the one in Isaiah. If you read the Ezekiel passage and you put it together, it would sound like Satan fell because of his exaltation, letting it go to his own head or whatever, and the great blessings that God had granted him. You move over to Isaiah chapter 14, verses 12 and 15. How you are fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. And this is, by the way, to the king of Babylon. How you are fallen from heaven. Oh, I don't think the king of Babylon was ever in heaven. O morning star, son of the dawn, you have been cast down to the earth, and you were laid low, and you once laid, I'm sorry, you who once laid low the nations. By the way, anybody have a King James or a New King James? I'm not going to pick on you this time. Okay? It says, Scott, this is your cue. How you've fallen from the heaven, O. What does the other translation say? Lucifer. Where do we get the name Lucifer applied to Satan? It's from Isaiah chapter 14. It's from the King James translation of Isaiah chapter 14. The Hebrew doesn't say Lucifer. The Hebrew says morning star, son of the dawn. Lucifer was a name for the morning star. Okay, so you won't find Lucifer in any manuscript, but that's why the name Lucifer is so often used for Satan. Nothing wrong with it. It just wants you to know where you'll find it and where you won't. Okay, how you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. You have been cast down to earth, you who once laid low the nations. You said in your heart. Now, here's going to be a description of what was going on that caused this rebellion. I will ascend to heaven. You can count the I wills here. That's one. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. Two. I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. Three. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. Four. I will make myself like the Most High. Five. Five statements of the desire of Satan when he fell. But you are brought down to the grave, to the depths of the pit. Now, the grave could apply to the king, but the pit, that's going to be an interesting one. We're going to see about the pit, the abyss, coming up pretty soon. So, the arrogance of the king of Babylon and the king of Tyre was like an earthly picture, an example, if you will, of the ultimate arrogance of Satan. So that's what caused this fatal character flaw that drives everything that he does. So Satan and his demons are angels who fell with Satan. And where's that described? Well, stay tuned. We're coming to it in Revelation. They are desperately evil. They are totally opposed to God and His plans for men. So if you are on God's side of this battle, you are the enemy of Satan. When we talk about spiritual warfare, that doesn't have to do with going around sniffing out demons and having what some people call power encounters. Now, can there be encounters between humans and demons? Yes, there can be, but spiritual warfare is a reality. It's not something you have to go enlist for. When you profess Christ, when you became an adopted child of God, you became a target of Satan. Spiritual warfare is living the Christian life. It is a battle. It's a battle mainly of ideas, but it is a battle against world forces of darkness, which is Satan and his demons. Now, let me give you some of the details to fill this in. These are in your notes. I won't belabor them. But here's some of the biblical names and the descriptions of Satan. John 12:31, he's called the prince of this world. When you see the word world most of the time in the New Testament, it's a Greek word you know, cosmos. Carl Sagan didn't invent it. That's the Greek word cosmos, K-O-S-M-O-S. Okay, do any of you own anything called cosmetics? Okay. It comes from this word because it's the idea of the appearance of the world. So cosmetics is dealing with appearance. It's dressing something up. Okay, the cosmos is used in the word cosmos is used for the whole world system, which is anti-God. 1 John 2:16. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the cosmos, from the world. So the world system, which is under the control of Satan right now, is the cosmos. He's also called, in Ephesians 2, 1 and 2, the prince of the power of the air. You were dead in your trespasses and sins in which you formerly walked according to the course of this cosmos, this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. So the idea is he's the ruler of this age. He's the one in charge of this world system. Why can't we get peace on earth? Well, it's under the control of a murdering liar from the beginning. He's also called the God of this age, referring to this evil age, 2 Corinthians 4:4. He is called the prince or the ruler of demons, Matthew 12:24 and Luke 11:15. He is called he who is in the world, as opposed to He who is in you, in 1 John 4:4, he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. Satan, he is called by that name. That word means adversary or opposer. That one's used 55 times in the Bible. That's the most common name for him. But he's got a whole flock of names. He's called the devil. That one's used 35 times. That means slanderer or false accuser. There's another Greek word behind the word devil that you know. Okay, diabolos, right? Diabolical, devilish. That's where that word comes from. He is called the old serpent. Save that one for Revelation 12:9. We're going to come to that. He's called the great dragon three times in Revelation chapter 12. And by the way, Revelation chapter 12 is a lot of the background about Satan. We'll see that when we get there. He's called the great dragon. Then he's also called the evil one. I don't guarantee that that's every name that he is given or every way that he's referred to. But lest you think that Satan has one scrap of goodness or kindness in him, and therefore he would be kind to people who are on his side, stop thinking that. Look at his description in 1 Peter 5:8. Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. He's just not a nice guy. Now, along with Satan, there is a great host of other fallen angels. The angels were all created at one time. Some of them fell in the rebellion with Satan. Apparently, there was some window of opportunity that they had. It does not appear that there are any more falling, but there are Satan and his demons. They're fallen angels. Some people say that demons are the spirits of a pre-Adamic race. We got a real problem with that. There's no such thing as a pre-Adamic race. But if you like to believe mythology, you could come up with something like that. They are not the ones called the Nephilim in Genesis chapter 6, or the fallen ones. And they're not just figments of people's imaginations. Demons are not just bad habits. You know, this guy has to deal with his own demons. Well, if he has to deal with demons, I'm going to pray for him. But, you know, it's much more than just something you think or something you do. They are angels who rebelled along with Satan. Where do we get that idea? Well, Matthew 25:41. This is in the Olivet Discourse. That's the end times part of the book of Matthew, Matthew 24 and 25. And this is describing, in the context of describing things that are going to happen after Jesus returns again. And you can read it in its own context, but you get down to Matthew 25:41, it says, "Then he will say to those who are on his left." Okay, who's that? Clearly Democrats, right? No, that's not. Left and right, sheep and goats, right? So these are the goats. "He will say to those who are on his left, 'Depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels.'" There are angels who follow the devil. He's the leader of them, right? Revelation 12:9. I'll give you this much of a sneak preview, but here is where. It's the one and only passage from which we get the understanding that apparently about one-third of the angels God created rebelled against Satan. So they're outnumbered 2-1. Revelation 12:9. "And the great dragon was thrown down," and we'll deal with this in its context, but just take this much. "The great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan." There's two of his names side by side. Well, actually, three of them, serpent of old, devil, and Satan. Four of them, great dragon, serpent of old, devil, and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He's got the whole world in his hands. You know, we might sing that about the wrong one, in a sense. Yes, God has everything in control. Don't dismiss that. But He is the one who is the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and His angels were thrown down with Him. And I guess I didn't get the right verse there. That's where it says a third of the stars of heaven went with Him. So that's the rather enigmatic place that we decide He took a third of them. So demons are spirit beings, as all angels are. When I say a spirit being, I mean a non-corporeal being. They don't have a physical body. You can't pinch an angel. They don't have a physical existence like we do. They are capable of affecting the lives of people who do not know Christ. They can affect Christians as well through ideas and persuasion, deception, especially those who allow themselves to come in contact with demons through false doctrine and through occult activities. That's a doorway to get yourself more involved with demons than anybody ought to want to be. They are morally perverted in every way. That's why they're often called evil spirits or unclean spirits. Now, what do? Their main work is writing. Their main work is creating doctrines. 1 Timothy 4, 1 through 3. The Spirit explicitly says that in the later times, some will fall away from the faith. So there will be people who profess to follow Christ and they'll fall away. That's what apostate means. Paying attention to deceitful spirits. Well, who's that? The spirits that deceive the world, Satan and his guys. The doctrines and to doctrines of demons by means of hypocrisy of liars seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron. Those are the ones who fall away. Now, I don't want to verbally abuse anybody. I don't want to step on any toes. But we have in the sentence that I'm in the middle of reading a couple of examples of doctrines of demons, things authored by Satan and his guys. Would you like a couple of examples? Men who forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods, which God has created to be gratefully shared in by those who believe and know the truth. Have you ever heard of anyone who says it is more spiritual or it is required of spiritual leaders to remain unmarried, or it is more spiritual to abstain from certain foods? I hear that there are people like that somewhere in the world. Those are doctrines of demons. Okay, enough said there. The conduct of Satan and his demons is always evil. It's always deceptive. And as I said, they primarily work through the human teachers of false doctrines. 2 Corinthians 11, 13 through 15. Paul was dealing with some false teachers, and he says, such men are false apostles. There were guys going around following Paul and calling themselves super apostles. He says they are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. That's Satan's number one thing, is packaging, writing bad doctrine and packaging it in nice people and nice sounding things. He says this, and no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. Therefore, it is not surprising if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their deeds. My doorbell rang the other day, and there was a boy about, I would guess, what, Bruce, maybe 12 years old. Yeah, probably about a 12-year-old boy with a woman, perhaps his mom. I'm not sure. He was wearing a tie. She was wearing a nice dress, a nice outfit, and they had a piece of paper to hand to me. And so I answered the door, and they said, "Good afternoon, sir. We are emissaries of Satan. We are on our way to the lake of fire, and we would very much like you to take this literature and read it and believe it so you can join us there. Wait a minute. Bruce had the same one at his house. That's not how they portrayed it, right? No, it was a nice piece of literature with a couple of nice people standing there who very nicely said, "We would like to invite you to a celebration of the resurrection of Jesus." Okay? I like Jesus. He rose from the dead. I'm pretty happy about that. Since I have to work on Easter, I declined. But, you know, they're never honest. It's always packaged to look good. It's always worded to sound good. It's always represented by somebody that looks like they'd be a really nice person to know. And they probably are really nice people to know, those who are there. But it's deception. So, I'm saying all of this because we're going to meet a bunch of demons in the next chapter of Revelation. Demons are emissaries of Satan. They are his angels for carrying out anti-God and anti-man activities. They have lots of different techniques, always harmful to the people who become involved with them in any way. That's why demons are willing to be used as God's tools of judgment. Do they know they're being used by God? I don't know. But they're doing what they're doing willingly. Now, in your notes is a summary chart of angels and demons. Now, it can look a little bit detailed there, but let me describe it this way. Work your way from left to right across that chart. God created angels. How many angels did he create? The Bible doesn't say. Something like gobs and gobs. There is a description of them in one place. Myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands. Or if you have the King James, they try to get literal with some of the words. 10,000, and then they chose times. 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. Okay? 10,000 is 10 to the fifth power. If it is 10,000, 10,000s, if you do multiply those, you get 10 to the 10th power at least. Well, that's way more than there are people on the earth. And then there's just, you know, for the security team, thousands of thousands beyond that. Okay? So the question is always asked, is it possible that you have a guardian angel? We're not going to take that side trip. It's possible there are enough angels to go around. Guardian angel is the concept that there is one angel assigned to look after an individual person. There's plenty to go around. God can use angels any way that he wants to. God does, according to Hebrews 1, use angels for the good of his children. He could care for you with an angel if he want to. There are some goose bumpy spine tingling stories of possible angelic intervention in things. There are things like God sending, you know, the angelic army and then opening the eyes of the prophet to see that you're not alone. You know, I got a few thousand people with flaming swords and stuff like that. So there are plenty to go around. I don't think you can prove the case that you have a guardian angel. God uses angels any way he wants to, but I think he plays his own defense. I don't think it's a man-to-man. So that's my way of describing it. That's my tribute to March Madness. That's as far as I'll go with doing that. But God created angels, and there are plenty of them. All right. Then you have a split. Now you have, since Satan's rebellion, holy angels and fallen angels, or demons. All right. The demons are outnumbered about 2-1. So roughly a third. Let's just say a third went with Satan. Those are the demons. Now, the holy angels, it's easy to chart them. They are holy. They're confirmed in holiness. They're always holy. They joyfully serve God. Every time we see him in Revelation, they're announcing something on behalf of God or singing God's praises. They're very good. They are holy. And they will be involved in eternal worship. We see that they're still around at the end of Revelation. They're eternally going to worship and serve God. It's the demons where it gets more complicated. The demons are fallen angels, the devil and his angels, Matthew 25:41. Now, among the demons, you have a split. There are loose demons and there are bound demons. Loose demons, when I say that, I mean they are not incarcerated. They're not on a leash. They are free to roam around. And for example, we've already seen some in Mark. I put Mark 5 on there as an example. We'll get to Mark 5. They're the ones that can inhabit a person, possess a person, work through a person, control a person. There are demons on the loose. Now, there are demons that are bound. By that I mean imprisoned. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 19 tells us that Jesus, while his body was in the tomb, went to a place and made a proclamation, it says, to the spirits now in prison. It's a place called a prison. It's called a couple different things. It's also called Tartarus. That's a place of imprisoned spirits. If that word comes from Greek mythology, and since I hate tartar sauce, I always picture that as paddling around in tartar sauce. Okay, that would be eternal torture for me. Okay, some of them are bound. Now, it gets more complicated. There's another split. Some of those who are bound are permanently bound. How do we know that? We know that from Jude verses 6 and 7, which happened to be what I wrote my master's thesis on. Those are some demons that are in a prison now, and the only time they're going to be let out of that prison is to be led to the great white throne where they will be judged and sent to the lake of fire for eternity. So some of them got a life sentence. Some of them are temporarily bound. We know they're in a prison, but they're going to be released. How do we know that? I'm so glad you asked, because that's what it says in Revelation chapter 9. Some of them are going to be released. So, that's the summary of angels and demons. All the holy angels will eternally be worshiping God with us. Okay? All the demons, whether they are loose, permanently bound, or temporarily bound, they will all be eventually in the lake of fire. They're not there yet. Lake of fire, best we can tell, still empty. Okay? But they're all going to be there. So that's a background on angelology and demonology. And we're about to dive into Revelation chapter 9. So, here's the point where while my paper monitors do their work, if while they're passing that around, if you have any questions, now's a good time to go for it. Yes, sir. He said in Ezekiel 28, it's like it's a lament over Satan. And it does say, isn't that the one that says, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre? Yeah, I mean, it is expressing God's heart of sorrow over those that have rebelled against him. But you said, why do I think that's included? Yeah, I don't think Satan cares. I think it's included to keep us busy when we're studying angelology and demonology so we can debate over. I don't know. That falls in my category of when a question starts with why, if the text itself doesn't say, we can't really answer it. But I do think it at least serves to tell us something about the motivation of someone as wicked as the king of Tyre. and that would be in cahoots with the activity of Satan. So, if nothing else, if we are correct in saying that Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 do speak to those wicked kings and beyond them to Satan, that to me is enough reason why it's there and why he spoke of it that way. So. Yes, sir. Let me repeat that so everybody's with us here, and then, yeah. What he's saying, he's run into the teaching that says that demons and angels come from humans. What's the movie? It's A Wonderful Life. Is that the one where every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hollywood loves that idea. Hollywood loves quite a few things that are not exactly biblically accurate. Okay. I don't want to lay blame where it doesn't belong, but I would say from my experience in realms of Catholic mysticism, stuff like that could come up. But yeah, that's the idea that demons and angels are disembodied spirits. And it's kind of like you can get a promotion to angelhood when you get to heaven. I could make a case for you that to become an angel would be a demotion, but I'm not going to do it because God created man with a very specific purpose to glorify him forever. So, I accept the comment you're looking for. You know, what can I do to give an answer to that? You can read good stuff. Do you have the book Biblical Doctrine by MacArthur and Mayhew? Okay, look up, read the Angelology and Demonology chapter in that. That'll be very good. There's a really good book. It's a paperback about 3/4 inch thick called Angels, Elect and Evil. Now, it's a two-edged book. The good edge is it is a very straightforward, well done, not speculative study of all of the occurrences of the references to angels and demons in the Bible. The author is C, Fred Dickinson, not Dickinson, Dickinson. Okay. The other edge of that is, after he wrote that fantastic book on angels and demons that I have used as a textbook in theology courses that I've taught, about 20 years later, he went hook, line, and sinker down the rabbit hole of mystical dealing with demons and saying that Christians can be demon-possessed and you have to go through all of these rituals and these special things. And he wrote another book called Christians and Demons. It should have been one page long. No such thing. Okay? And his book on Christians and demons is about 3 inches thick, and the print isn't this big. So I cannot at all recommend C. Fred Dickinson, but he wrote a really good book back in the 1970s, probably. But you're going to find all the stuff in that book. There are others that are good as well, but I'm not going to come up with them on my thinking on my feet. Okay, any more before we pretend we're going to start the next section? You were saying you were talking about Stephen Hawking, who died today, and saying he was an atheist. And I said, until today. Oh dear, Saved by the Bell. I don't have time to get going. Okay, he's saying his body will be in the grave. His spirit will be in where? Hades. That is a legitimate description of that. Sheol is the Hebrew word. Hades is the Greek word. They describe the same place, and it is a place of departed spirits. Now, we say people are in heaven or in hell. We know what we mean by that. For a believer, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. But the resurrection has not taken place yet. Now, That means that the spirits of believers are in the presence of Christ. Remember chapter 6? The ones that have been martyred, they're calling out from under the altar. How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you avenge our blood? So spirits, they're fully cognitive, fully aware, awake, alive. The idea of sleeping, that's the body. That's the metaphor for the body. The body falls asleep. But what about unbelievers if they're not yet in what we call hell or the lake of fire? And they're not yet. Well, they are in a place of departed spirits. It's not a nice place. Not a pretty place. Read Luke 17 or is it 19? The rich man and Lazarus? 16. Yeah, I didn't even come close. I missed it twice. I'd say that. Luke 16. The rich man and Lazarus. And their spirits are in places. Now, for reasons I don't have time to explain to you now, I don't think believers are in that place that Lazarus was. And that's not the Lazarus that Jesus raised. That's another man named Lazarus. Okay, but the unbelievers, I think, are in that place. And by the way, it's not a good place. It's still not the lake of fire, but torment. Oh, can you dip your finger in the water and just give me a little relief? So, yeah, that would be where that person's, any person's the non-physical part of them, soul, spirit, heart, mind, will, I mean, everything but the body is there. A holding place. Theologians like to have fancy words, so they call it the intermediate state. Meaning, like what? Sort of like Boston Airport right now. Yeah, a holding place, an intermediate state on your way to somewhere else. It is that. One of the side trips I'm almost certain to take you on, but I want to wait until we get way down toward the end of Revelation. I would like to do a little study with you on the unreal estate mentioned in the Bible. All the places mentioned in the Bible that you can't drive to, fly to, or get to any other way, take a boat to. Or a study of, we might call it the nether world, the places of spirits in that. It sounds kind of confusing when you read them, here, there, and everywhere. When you put them all in a summary, it kind of makes a whole lot of sense. And that'll be one of our side trips that we will take. So, let me take you now to I hid my notes from myself. There we go. What I just handed out, keep it, hang on to it. We're going to need it. We're going to need it next week. But we've been through four of the trumpet judgments. Four angels have blown their trumpets. Horrible things have happened. And then there's that little interlude. Woe, woe, woe for the things that are yet to come. It's going to get even worse. And that starts with Revelation chapter 9. And we're going to see the final three trumpet judgments in Revelation chapter 9, which are those three woes. We're going to have a little bonus about God's use of the devil. And then when we get into chapter 10, we're going to see John's recommissioning. Interesting thing, kind of like he gets recharged about halfway through the book. But get a load of how this starts in Revelation chapter 9, verse 1. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. What does it mean when you give somebody a key? Ownership, okay. What else? Access, Okay? You know, opening and closing. Now, who do you think this star might be? Or what do you think this star might be? Okay? Steve always reads ahead. He says, an angel. Okay? Think it's the devil? So, well, he's really been reading ahead. Okay? I don't think it's Satan, but it probably is a danger. How can you tell? Well, it's not a literal star because it's not something that comes from the heavens like we saw in the first four trumpet judgments. And there are some clues in this chapter. This star has intelligence. It's not inanimate. This is a being of some sort, a sentient being. This star is referred to with personal pronouns, him and he. So it's not a star falling out of the heavens. And I want you to notice again that the principles of interpretation for the book of Revelation are the same as for other books. You know, there are things here that are symbolic. There is symbolic language, like this star. All right? But you can't just read in anything that you want to read into its interpretation. Now, there are many commentators who say that this star is possibly or probably Satan. I'm pretty sure if you have a MacArthur study Bible, you'll find words, but I'm pretty sure it's there because I'm pretty sure I looked at it this afternoon, that say this is an angel. He either uses the word possibly or probably Satan himself. I'm going to show you as we work our way through this chapter why I think it's pretty obvious that it can't be Satan. But it does seem clear from what he does that this is an intelligent creature. And this time, when God allows at least some of those demons who are imprisoned to be freed, apparently he lets an angel or a fallen angel let them loose. So he, if you will, allows a jailbreak. Interesting where these things come from. Oh, I'm sorry. He'd fallen. I skipped that part. That means, in its perfect tense, he'd fallen before the time that John saw anything. So this was a fallen one. And he was given the key. That's a way of saying God is allowing this to happen. God is allowing them to be released. And they're going to come from a place called the bottomless pit. That's really interesting. And remember I said some of the angels are bound, or some of the demons are bound? And I said some of them are bound temporarily? How do we know that? Because we're watching their release. They're bound now, and they're going to be set free at that time. All right, so we'll put the bookmark in there, and we will come back to this point next time and continue working our way through. That we should be able to finish John 9 and 10 for sure. Next time we might even get into chapter 11.